Blog Talk Radio.
Last Monday's blizzard may have been a bust, but today, oh my goodness, so much ice and snow. I'm looking at the Adirondack chair in my backyard, and at least two-thirds of it is totally covered. This is not a night to be going out and about, but a night to put on your slippers, grab a nice comfy blanket, and snuggle in with me. I'm Cindy Wolf Boynton, and this is the February 2nd, 2015 Literary New England Radio Show. Tonight, I'll bring you conversations and book giveaways with Stuart Onan on West of Sunset, Jennifer Robson on After the War is Over, Rebecca Sherm on Unbecoming, and Krassy Zirkova on Wild Alone. You can also win a copy of Wild Alone, this dark and imaginative debut novel that will be our first giveaway tonight. Like the author, Wild Alone's protagonist is a young woman named Thea, a Bulgarian-born Princeton student who finds magic and myth within the stone and Gothic towers of the Ivy League school. The story has been compared to Twilight, to Donna Tartt's The Secret History, which is set in New England, and to A Discovery of Witches. It blends Greek myths with Bulgarian folktales, conjuring, among other things, legendary forest witches called Wild Alones, who beguile and entrap men, and of course have a tie with Thea's family and her love life. In addition to being a writer, Krassy Zirkova has a law degree from Harvard, so one of the first things I wanted to know was whether she was practicing law in addition to writing.
I am doing both at the moment. I'm very lucky to be working at a firm that is very supportive of work-life balance. And so for the past couple of years, I have been working part-time as a lawyer and using the rest of my time to write. But really, writing, I've been doing it for so long as I remember, started writing poetry when I was six. So it's something that never left me, but I also was never planning on not doing it. So my schooling and then my career, my day job, I always made sure there's some time for writing left, hoping that one day I will do a lot more of it.
But you're not in Cambridge anymore.
No. I have lived all over the East Coast for several years. So after law school, I started working in New York at a law firm there, which is where almost all of my friends ended up after law school, and then had a brief period in Chicago, and then now I'm in Los Angeles, so slowly moving west.
So you have this wonderful new book out called Wild Alone. Please tell us what it is all about.
Wild Alone is the word that I coined. It's a literal translation of a Bulgarian word, Samudivi, which are creatures from Bulgarian folklore. They're wooden fairies. They come in the in the forest on the full moon, and they dance, and if a stranger sees them, they become very vicious, and they tear him to pieces. So that's the creature, and the story is about a girl from Bulgaria, Thea, who comes to college in America, and she's a very talented pianist, but she also has a dark secret about a sister that she used to have. She never knew about the sister, but 15 years ago, the sister died on the Princeton campus under mysterious circumstances. So Thea comes to the same school. She untangles the mystery of what happened to her sister, and in the process begins to discover this hidden world of myths and legends and witchcraft and magic, and also falls in love with two very mysterious and charming alpha boys.
So you are a Princeton graduate. You know, how much of this mystical, paranormal, magical kind of stuff actually happened?
Princeton itself is quite magical. And when I came as a freshman in 93, this was right before the internet hit, and I had not really seen even a single photo of the campus. So I had also never been to a Western country where you have this Gothic architecture. So all of a sudden I was in what to me felt like a place lifted out of a movie, literally. It's very Gothic, it's very eerie, and this stayed with me for the entire time I was a student there, even when I got used to the campus. But especially at night, you know, I would walk around and it felt like fairy tales were literally possible any moment. So that inspired me to write the book to a large degree. A lot of the story is autobiographical, what it's like to be a student there, but also, and this is my personal weakness or preference or what have you for magical realism, I try to live my life and also convince others, if I can, to always keep an eye out for the magical in the everyday. And, you know, people talk about little coincidences or luck or things that happen to all of us, and we can think of them as random happenings and ignore them, or we can sort of believe that there's a bit of magic in our lives. I don't know if that makes sense, but that is sort of what drove the feel of the story, where the magic was not overwhelming in the story, but it's always there, and you never quite know how much of it is reality and how much of it is the paranormal and the mythical.
So did you start conceptualizing this story while you were at Princeton?
No, not at all. I first thought of these creatures, and I felt haunted by them when I was working as a lawyer in New York. It could have been that because I was working so much, and I was working in finance especially, so part of me was really craving the magical, and I remember almost obsessively reading fairy tales and children's books and a lot of poetry. And so at the time I wrote a poem about them. That's when I came up with the word Wild Alone. And then several years later, it was actually after the Twilight books came out, and I read the first one, and that's when the story came to me, really. All of a sudden, I just saw it as a very viable story. And the first thing I knew about it was that I wanted to write something very Gothic, something that would be very rooted in reality and in the lives of an ordinary girl like myself, but also have legends in it, and love and death, and sort of these magical things taken to the extreme and interwoven with the real.
Huh, so how long did it take you to actually write it? Did you start writing away, or did you, you know, I guess I'm curious, are you a plotter or a planner?
I joke with this question. I was asked once before, and I say that I'm a prankster, because I plot a lot in my head, really. I don't plot with pen and paper, and I feel like I know where the story would go, and then as I start writing it, I try to shock myself and say, okay, what if I took it exactly in the opposite direction? And this happened even in the story. There are a lot of plot twists, and some of them were really not intended. I thought it would be fascinating, you know. For example, once I thought, okay, what if this character does something really bad and you think there's no recovery from that, and then he recovers? And I thought, what if he does three really bad things in succession, right? And then, so that's what I do. The first draft took 7 months, and I think I was very naive in how long it would take and how much effort, really. When you read books that work, they seem to flow so naturally, you know, and I thought, okay, someone sat down and wrote it in a few months. And after the first draft, I realized that if I were to do the story justice, it would take much longer, and I had to do research and flesh out subplots and really create an entire world. Initially, it was just the love story, but it was going to be a very sort of different book, somewhat simplistic. So it ended up taking over 3 years, and then this was before I had an agent, and then the, you know, once you have an agent and you have a publisher, and everyone works with you a little bit more to improve the story. So overall, from beginning to end to now, it took 6 years almost to the day.
Wow. So you are from Bulgaria. Your
yes.
protagonist is from Bulgaria.
Yes.
Was there a part of you who wanted to play homage to or bring more awareness to your native country by writing this story?
Definitely. Yes. And I love myths and legends, and I also love how popular some of them are here. Vampires, obviously, you know, werewolves. I felt that the Wild Alones were almost completely unknown. They were somewhat known from the Harry Potter books. They were mentioned there as Vila, which is an alternative name for them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
We all know what that is, yes.
Mm-hmm. They're the same creatures, and they're not uniquely Bulgarian. They're from the Slavic myths and legends. So in other Slavic countries, they also exist. And since the languages are so similar too, the words are recognized by other, you know, Slavic language speakers. So the word Samudiva also shows up as Samuvila, and then the short one is Vila. So they're all alternate names for the same creature, but in the Harry Potter books, you know, obviously they're more from a child fairy tale perspective, and I wanted to give the sort of more grown up darker version, because they're not just fairies, but they're practically witches, very complicated creatures. They can fall in love, and then they can destroy the men they love. So that to me was fascinating, and I wanted to bring all of that. Eventually, what happened was very interesting. The myth of Orpheus, which is also central to the story, which Orpheus used to live in the lands that are currently in Bulgaria, but he's also very tied into Greek mythology. And so I started researching that and discovered that there were almost exact parallels between the Bulgarian creatures and the Greek creatures, menads or maenads, who tore Orpheus to pieces. And so I thought, oh wow, in the Balkans, I mean, we all live right there next to one another, and obviously our myths and legends, and they go back thousands of years, but they're really so similar. They're practically almost identical, and I wanted to show that as well and make it known here to readers in America.
I love it. As I told you earlier in our conversation, I really loved Wild Alone. I thought it was just a marvelous book. The writing is so very poetic. I wasn't surprised at all to read in your bio afterwards that you had mm-hmm. a background in poetry
mm-hmm.
Because you really, the writing is quite lush.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So your protagonist, Thea, how much is she like you?
A lot, for better or for worse. One thing that I think some readers find fascinating and other readers so far have found challenging and a bit bizarre is that she's a very successful, strong, driven, intelligent girl, But at the same time, she is not pushy. She is very sort of patient and quiet, and she thinks a lot before she does anything. And it's, to me, this is a fascinating discussion, because I grew up during communism, and the biggest virtues, and you know, at school, when you talk about indoctrinating kids, and that's exactly what was happening, but it was not a bad thing, you know. The virtues were humility, don't sell yourself, don't talk about how great you are, let your actions speak for you, also don't judge others, just learn and observe, and that I carry to this day, which sometimes works to my disadvantage, and it's the same with Thea in the book, you know. And I had to even explicitly say it, because it's so important to me, when she talks to one of her American friends and he says, "You never complain about anything," and she says, "Look, I've come to a new country, and first I have to understand what the whole thing is all about, right, before I can even think of judging anyone." What happens, though, is, you know, some people perceive that as being weak or naive. And to me, that's just part innocence, but part wisdom, you know. So she comes from a different culture and doesn't necessarily fit into what the readers here necessarily would expect from a main heroine. And sometimes I even get asked the feminist question, okay, she's with these alpha boys, and she's not the alpha female equivalent. Does that mean, you know, she can be a feminist? Does it mean readers can be feminists and enjoy this kind of love relationship? And I said, yes, definitely. You know, to me, strength doesn't have to be loud or explicit necessarily. It's more of strength in character.
That's right. And now, Wild Alone was published as a standalone book, but mm-hmm. it definitely ends in a way that would make a sequel possible.
Yes. Yes. The truth is, when the story came to me back in 2009, it was a much longer plot arc. And I thought about it for a while. I saw it in my mind almost as a movie. And I realized that it was a saga, really, just very long. So I started writing it. And after some time, this book took shape, and it felt like it had a natural mini ending, which doesn't resolve the ultimate story of Thea and the two brothers, and which one will she end up with, if either one at all, or would she do something else? So that's why it was published this way. And in a way, like a lot of stories, it resolves a lot of things. And as soon as you resolve one thing, it typically opens questions of another thing, and what happens now, right? Every time you find out a secret, the natural question is, now what? So that's what's happening with this ending. But ideally, yes, and I do have much more of the story in my mind. So hopefully there will be a sequel. But this is the one question that I have been asked so far, way more than any other question. So thank you for bringing it up too.
You're welcome. So now, online, readers who want to reach out to you, tell you how much they love the book, whatever, ask questions, Facebook is the best place to find you?
Facebook, yes. Krasi Zurkova, author. And I'm also on Twitter. My handle is my last name, Zurkova. I love hearing from readers, and, you know, sometimes the things readers say to me, they keep me up at night, and I love it. So I very, very much welcome that, and I always try to answer them. So that to me is really the biggest reward. And I know people say it, and it's a cliche, but it is true.
And what's your pitch for the book? Why should people pick it up?
Mostly, I would say people should pick it up if they want this sense of magic in their life. And I don't mean just bringing a fairy tale for a few hours, but the best thing anyone has said to me about the book so far, it happened some time ago. One of my friends read it and she said, you know, after I read a few pages, I all of a sudden feel like anything is possible. Literally, love is possible. Miracles are possible. I feel not so entrenched in the everyday anymore, in the mundane, and I have this feeling of hope. So that, I think that to me is the main reason. And when I read stories and they give me this feeling, this is really what I love the most as a reader. But that also is just curiosity. Sorry. Yeah, and anyone who's curious also about the mythology and the legends and this, I think would be of interest to readers as well.
That was a lovely compliment you received.
Yeah.
Crassy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
If you haven't already, win a copy of Wild Alone by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. And remember, if you can't stay with us until the end of our show tonight and hear all four author interviews live, you can download this episode anytime as an iTunes podcast or stream it from the Literary New England Radio Show archives. The latest novel by the wonderful Stuart Onan is called West of Sunset, and it focuses on the years F. Scott Fitzgerald lived and worked in Hollywood. You may not know it, but Fitzgerald has a New England connection. He and Zelda lived in the Compo Beach section of Westport for a while. Stuart, as I'm sure you know, is an award-winning fiction and nonfiction writer. He's actually on tour right now for West of Sunset, traveling to Asheville, North Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia over the next couple of weeks. Stuart has written so many wonderful books and has such a faithful legion of fans, but I couldn't remember just how many books he's written.
I think it's around book number 19 or 20, I think.
Do you ever worry that you're going to run out of ideas?
Well, of course. Of course. You always get to the end of something and you don't know what's next.
So where did this story come from? What drew you to Fitzgerald?
I was doing research on a nonfiction project in 1920s Hollywood, and I ran across a mention that he'd been out there in the 20s working on the silent films, and I'd never known that. I knew that he'd gone there in 37 and lived there for the rest of his life. And so I started thinking about his relationship with Hollywood and how he's always kind of trying to climb that mountain.
He always seemed to be climbing all kinds of mountains.
He made things tough on himself, I think. I mean, he lived a very eventful life.
Yeah, and he had such incredibly high standards. I don't know, do you think he ever was satisfied or happy with what he did?
Probably not, being an artist. But he had, I think, that what he called, for Gatsby, that willingness, that receptiveness to life. He was definitely very responsive to beauty and politics and art and music and everything. He wanted to absorb everything and get it down on the page.
So what made you decide to write this story? I mean, you could have written so many stories about Fitzgerald if that was, you know, the man that attracted you. You know, why this time period?
Well, this is after the crack-up. This is after the very worst has happened. You know, Zelda's in the asylum. His daughter's off at boarding school. He's kind of alone and homeless. He doesn't have a place to be, and he's dead broke. I mean, he's in debt to his agent, $13,000, when he goes out there. And he has to basically start all over again. And I've been writing about those kinds of people for the last, say, 10 years, people that have to find a way to go on and find a way to endure. And the way that he does it is like the way that a lot of my characters do it, which is just to work. He knows that he can write. He knows that he can sort of sit down with a blank page and make something exciting happen. And so he works. And he overworks himself, I think. But it's a legendary person in a legendary time and place, the golden age of the studio system. And, you know, to be on the lot there on MGM while they're shooting, say, The Wizard of Oz, or the all-nighters that he spends with David O. Selznick writing Gone with the Wind. I mean, it's just, Stephen King said the book takes you away, and I wanted to sort of be taken away to that time and place.
So what kind of research did you do, Stuart? Did you watch a lot of old movies? Did you kind of go to Hollywood and try to put yourself back 80 years?
I didn't go to L.A. because that L.A. is gone. It's long gone. But I read as much of the contemporary fiction of the time. People like John Fonte and Raymond Chandler and Nathaniel West and Horace McCoy. And, of course, Fitzgerald's own The Last Tycoon, which is a beautiful, beautiful book. I must have read that thing 8 or 9 times while I was writing this book. And also I looked at the films from the period, both the sort of the fiction films from Hollywood and the behind-the-scenes things. And I looked at a lot of pictorial books, sort of histories of the studios and the restaurants and the nightlife of that time. I wanted to go to the Coconut Grove and go dancing there. I wanted to go to the Brown Derby. You know, there's a lot of glamour at that time, and here it's being seen through the eyes of what is probably our greatest romantic.
Yeah, it really was such a different time. Do you think that we tend to over-romanticize that time, or was it really that fabulous with the gloves and the long cigarettes and the clubs and the dancing?
Well, of course, it was both. It was, you know, the height of glamour, but also just regular, you know, human striving. I mean, Scott can't pay his rent. He has to go hawk his car. So there's the irony there that here he is among the most successful people and glamorous and beautiful people in the world, and he's, you know, a total, total failure, and yet has to project this image of success there. But to his credit, he falls in love. So it's a romance as well. And that romance, I think, revives him, brings him back to life.
You know, Maureen Corrigan from NPR wrote that wonderful book about why we keep going back to The Great Gatsby and why we love it so much. Why is it, do you think, Stuart, that we love Fitzgerald himself so much? Because artists really are drawn to him in so many different genres of art.
Well, it's his story, that great early heady success that he has with This Side of Paradise. In 1920, he's the highest paid writer, most famous writer in America, and he's got this beautiful flapper wife, and they're living this high life. They're on magazine covers everywhere, and they're representative of the times. They're held up as, you know, this you know, the apogee of American success. And then across the 20s, he has great success, I think, with Gatsby. But after that, Zelda starts having her problems, ends up in the asylum. He ends up drunk and not producing much of anything. You know, and by 1929, along with the country, they've kind of crashed. So it's that early success and that fall from grace that attracts most people to Fitzgerald. But for me, it's that later Fitzgerald. It's the professional in him. From 1919 onwards, all he did was write. That was his métier. If he got in a tight spot, he would just write more and write harder and write better.
Was it hard for you to get in his head?
Well, not really, because, I mean, what do I do? You know, I sit down every day with a blank page and just sort of trust that something's going to come and try and try and try. And you know, sometimes you succeed and sometimes you fail. I haven't had sort of the peaks and valleys that he's had, but I understand what it means, you know, to come to the desk day after day for 20 years.
So West of Sunset has been out for a couple of weeks now. Are you enjoying talking with readers about it and touring?
Yeah, very much, very much. I mean, it's always good to talk with readers. But, you know, it's funny, a lot of people come and they don't want to talk about the new book. They want to talk about Emily Alone, or they want to talk about Last Night at the Lobster. I mean, there's certain books of mine that they just have you know, taken to and really love. And that's great. I mean, I like the idea that, you know, every book has its champions.
See, now you're making me think about being at an Aerosmith concert, and I don't know if you've ever been to an Aerosmith concert.
I have,
you know,
I have indeed, yes.
You're all right, you're from Massachusetts, but, you know, I remember the last, I've been to quite a few, and, you know, they work so hard, and they put out these new albums, and everyone is, from the audience is screaming, you know, play the old
right.
stuff,
play the old
stuff, and sometimes you can see, you know, Steven Tyler getting all mad, like, what about this new stuff, you know? You know, do you ever get that kind of frustration?
No, not at all, not at all, because it's usually a nice distribution, you know, of people that like, say, Prayer for the Dying or Snow Angels, and so they like the old ones, they like the new ones, but everyone seems to have a favorite, and that's ideal. Now, to know that the readers care about the characters, you know, years after they've come out. I mean, that's perfect.
And what about you? Do you kind of hang on to them and have a love for them that same way?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, they're always there. You know, and some of them are stronger than others. I mean, characters like Emily, she's always there. And Marjorie from The Speed Queen is always there. And, you know, when you write it, you know that they're there. And you feel that you can go back to that book and those worlds, and they're still going to be there. It's like when you read one of your favorite books, you know, by other authors. You know, I can go back to The Lighthouse, and the Ramses are going to be there. You know, or when I read William Maxwell, you know, that small town in Illinois is going to be there, and I like that feeling.
Yes. And now, taking on Fitzgerald, you weren't afraid to tackle such an iconic guy who people feel really strongly about?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's hard because everyone has their own Fitzgerald, you know, so you have to somehow overcome that or work with that, you know, and meet the reader halfway at times. Same thing, everyone has their own Dorothy Parker. Everyone has their own Humphrey Bogart. So when you're working with these biographical figures, you know, you're working both with and against the reader at the same time. But the fact that there's a nonfiction interest in the fiction book, it makes it, I think, gives it a little broader appeal.
I have to tell you, I've never read a biography about Fitzgerald. I've read quite a bit of the fictional stories about Zelda. And you know what? In some of those stories, I like Fitzgerald a lot. And in some of them, though, you know what? I think he's kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of sort of revisionist versions of Zelda since Nancy Mitford's biography back in the late 60s, early 70s. Zelda as feminist icon. Fitzgerald, when he was sober, was the most proper and courtly and perfect gentleman you'll ever meet. Wonderful, wonderful manners. When he was a drunk, he was just a terrible, angry mess.
Hmm.
And that makes him, I think, a good character, because he's always some sort of trouble. He's always putting too much pressure on himself and then falling apart. And I think Zelda was the same way. She's a great character in that way.
And I guess when you are... my dog likes your book a lot. I guess when you're a novelist, it doesn't matter so much whether you like your protagonist as much as that you have a story that you can tell, that they are a character, and that I guess even when you're really unlikable, you have qualities that people can relate to.
Well, I do think you have to like your characters. In fact, I think at times you really have to love your characters and understand them. Fitzgerald said for him to write about a character, he had to feel an emotion that he understood. And when I think of both Scott and Zelda, I have emotions for them that I think I understand, and get emotions from them I think I understand. So I hope that I can connect with them. John Gardner said that if a character is worthy of and capable of love, then we'll follow them anywhere. And I think that's true, and certainly Scott and Zelda were very, very much capable and worthy of love.
I love that quote, and you are absolutely right. Is there something that you want people to close West of Sunset having learned or felt or experienced?
I guess his devotion, I think, his devotion to Zelda, his feelings of responsibility and trying to do the right thing. He was a man who really did try to do the right thing much of his life, and worked very hard trying to do that. And sometimes he failed. Sometimes he didn't live up to his responsibilities, but he felt them very deeply.
What about you? What about Stuart Onan? What do you want them to think or feel about Stuart at the end?
Not too much. I mean, I don't really care too much. I mean, the characters are much more important than the writer. You know, as Stephen King says, it's the tale, not he who tells it.
So now you've mentioned Stephen King twice. I know that you've collaborated before. Do you guys work together at all? I mean, even though you're not collaborating, is he someone who perhaps, you know, gives your books a read and comment?
Yeah, I'll send him the manuscripts to see what he thinks of them. Yeah, oh, definitely. He's a great, great reader. And a very Catholic reader. He can read anything.
What a great reading buddy to have.
Well, yeah, I have a few of them. Dennis Lehane's a great, great, you know, reader of my work. And, you know, I've got this you know, very nice set of about 10 friends who read the book. But, of course, the best reader is my wife. And she will tell me, you know, when something's not working. She's not shy about letting me know.
And what's your wife's first name?
Trudy.
Well, then a shout out to Trudy.
Oh, yeah.
Good for her. And, Stuart, we need to wrap things up. Where can people find you on the Internet to reach out and learn more?
We have a Facebook page, Stuart Onan, and we also have a website, stuartonan.com.
And there's a hyphen there between
yes.
Stuart and Onan.
Yes.
Stuart, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you, Cindy.
You might have heard my dog Holly give a shout out to Stuart. Holly loves books and is just as excited about West of Sunset as any of us are. Win a copy of that novel by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Do the same to win a copy of Jennifer Robson's After the War is Over, a historical novel that takes us back to the end of World War I. Jennifer was at R.J. Julia Bookstore in Madison, Connecticut this past weekend, speaking as part of a panel that also included fellow best-selling authors Sarah McLean and Lauren Willig. She was supposed to be at the Wilton, Connecticut Public Library tonight, but the weather caused that event to be canceled, as well as many others like it throughout New England. Hopefully, that Wilton event will be rescheduled soon, because Jennifer is just a delightful and entertaining woman and speaker, and she has a lot going on. In addition to the recent release of After the War is Over, it was announced a week or so ago that she'll be part of an anthology that's being put together by Connecticut fiction writer Heather Webb, which will feature stories all set at the same time of World War I. Heather Webb was on our show last week talking about both the anthology and her latest novel, Rodin's Lover. You can find that interview in the Literary New England Radio Show archives. But right now, our focus is Jennifer Robson, who has so much to celebrate.
I do. It's a wonderful time, I have to say. I'm constantly pinching myself to make sure that it's actually coming true and it's not just an extremely elaborate waking dream.
And the anthology is being coordinated by a Connecticut writer, Heather Webb.
The wonderful Heather Webb, yes. It was Heather's idea, and she has put so much work into this, pulling together this terrific group of writers and some, you know, some very well-known writers, Beatrice Williams, Lauren Willig, and what holds us together is that all of us write about the period of the Great War and its aftermath. And so the unifying principle for this anthology is the idea of the Armistice Day, November 11th, 1918, the day that there's an end to the hostilities and what happened on that day or following it to the various characters we've created in our stories. And so I'm working away on my story at the moment and having a lot of fun with it, actually. I don't want to say too much at this stage before my editor gets her hands on it, but one of the main characters in my story is actually a music hall actress. So that's something that, you know, we've almost forgotten about things like music halls and so on. But if you imagine the great Charlie Chaplin, he didn't get his start in the movies. He got his start on the music hall stage in Britain at the turn of the century, turn of the last century. And so I'll be looking at this one particular character and how the end of the war affects her.
Oh, that's so neat. And now you have two published novels, I believe,
yes.
Somewhere in France, and your latest, After the War is Over.
I do, yes.
Both are involve, as you said, the Great War, World War One. Why that time period?
So it's you know, it's something that's in my blood. I grew up with a history professor as a father, my wonderful dad, who's only just retired, and I'm not sure if it'll stick. He keeps retiring, and then he gets dragged back to teach a course here or teach a course there. His name's Stuart Robson, and his career was spent teaching the history of the First and Second World Wars. By training, his specialty is German history, but he soon moved on from that. And he was always interested in what he's called the crucible of the World Wars, what they did to the 20th century, the effect they still continue to have on us today. And so it was the kind of thing we talked about at home. And I don't mean the specifics of this battle or that battle. But, you know, what it meant to be a soldier in that war, to be related to a soldier in that war. And on both sides of both my mom and dad's families, we had veterans, you know, the great-grandfather level who had fought in the war, and relatives, you know, who had died. My grandmother's uncle, for example, was killed during the war. And we always, you know, it was something I just found a source of continuing interest. And Dad can make anything interesting, but the war, he made it fascinating to me. And he was the one who gave me Wilfred Owen for the first time, the great war poet, who was killed a week before the armistice in 1918. And I discovered Wilfred Owen's poetry when I was probably about 15 or 16 through my dad, which is a very good time to discover poetry that's very tragic. And certainly his, not only, you know, it brought the war to life in a way that novels hadn't been able to do for me at that stage. And then later in my teens, right at the very end of my teens, I ended up working for a summer at the Canadian National Vimy Memorial in northern France. And it's a huge park and memorial and museum complex that's administered by the Canadian government in France. It's about halfway between Paris and Lille. And they have university students as guides there every summer. And so I was there the summer of 1989, and it was one of the final summers, I think, that we would have seen reasonable numbers of veterans of the First World War coming to visit. And so I was fortunate enough to meet any number of those men. And, you know, I mean, I certainly wouldn't have been leading the tour. I wouldn't have been guiding them. I just, with my fellow guides, we followed them around and listened to what they had to say. And then also had the chance to thank them and to shake their hands and to, you know, promise them that we wouldn't forget. And I've never forgotten that summer and all the stories that my dad told me. And I think in a way, you know, this is my roundabout way of saying that it was inevitable that I ended up writing about the First World War.
Huh. So tell us, please, about this new book, After the War is Over. Where does it take us?
Well, it's, you know, the title is, as you can tell, super opaque and very hard to make out the focus of the book. But what it does is it focuses on Charlotte Brown, who is a secondary character in my first book, Somewhere in France. During the war, Charlotte has an Oxford education, although not a degree. Women weren't granted degrees at Oxford until 1920, but she has an education. She spent 4 years at one of the women's colleges, and after graduating from Oxford, I think it's about 1907, she ends up working as a governess for a short period for the woman who later becomes the heroine of Summer in France. And then, eventually has to leave work as her governess because she's Lily's 18. She doesn't need a governess anymore. And so Charlotte goes to work as a social worker in Liverpool. And then during the war, though, she feels she needs to be doing more. So she ends up working as a nurse. She trains as a nurse and works as a hospital in London. And it's a nurse senior hospital, which we would now term not nurse senior, but PTSD. So she spends the war taking care of soldiers who've been very badly traumatized by their experiences. And then after the war, the job evaporates as a nurse, and she returns to Liverpool to work again as a social worker and tries to get on with her life. She's in her early 30s. She's not married. There's no prospect of getting married, and it's not really something she seeks out. And all around her she sees people suffering from the after effects of the war, not just the loss of loved ones. There's the toll it took on people, the men who were wounded and came home and found very little in the way of benefits or programs or assistance. And there's also terrible unemployment throughout the British industrial north at the towns that had been factory towns or the great the seaports. The shipyards were closing, mass unemployment everywhere. And this predates 1929 and the economic collapse. Things were tough all through the 20s in much of northern Britain. And so she's asking herself, what do I do to go on from here? How do I make a life that is meaningful, that has value? And all the while she's trying to do that, and part of which she accomplishes by starting to write a newspaper column describing the work she does, she keeps being pulled back into the life of her friend Lily, who is an aristocrat. And Charlotte herself comes from a nice family, but certainly not, she doesn't move in the same circles. And not only Lily, but Lily's brother, Edward, who she's always been friends with. It's a difficult friendship. And he's come back from the war wounded not just in body, but in soul. He's a broken man. And it's Charlotte's efforts to save him and the world around her that are the cornerstone of this book.
And now one of the things that you and Charlotte have in common is that you both went to Oxford.
We did, yes, or I did. It feels like quite a long, long time ago now. I was there in the early 1990s, and it was, I won't lie to you, it was a wonderful experience. I went straight from doing my undergraduate.
Well, how could it not be?
Well, it was, it can be an intimidating experience. You go from feeling very much the superstar in your own little kind of liberal arts college back home to sitting in seminars with people who you quickly realize are the smartest people you're ever likely to meet. And I was at a wonderful college, St. Anthony's College, which was mostly international students. I would say maybe a third of the students there were British, and then two-thirds were from countries all around the world. Quite a lot of Americans, I have to say, which was lovely because we could all commiserate with all the things we missed from North America, sports being among, the top of the list. None of us could really figure out cricket, and we all missed our football and hockey and baseball. But it was a magical time, and I wish the 45-year-old me had had a chance to experience it rather than the 22-year-old me. I feel as if maybe I might have appreciated it a little bit more. But the chance to sit and work in libraries that date to the 17th century, to go to the wonderful balls, I rode for my college, and to go. Rowing on the Isis, which is the name the Thames is called. When it goes through Oxford, it's renamed the Isis for reasons that are lost in the midst of time, I think. And just to walk the streets of this ancient city that has modern life kind of superimposed upon it. But you don't have to scratch very deep to find the Oxford of the 1500s. And there are several scenes in After the War's Over that are set in Oxford as flashback to when Charlotte is there in the Edwardian period. And you know, it was a time they were slowly making room for women, but it wasn't the friendliest place for women to be. And you know, I think you had to be pretty brave. I think you were really you know, breaking down a lot of barriers as a woman if you attended Oxford or Cambridge or any of the other universities in those days. And whereas when I was at Oxford, it was very congenial. I never, you know, encountered any difficulties because I was a woman. Some because I was a Canadian and with my colonial background, but never because I was a woman.
So clearly that experience, I mean, it stayed with you in your mind, at least that place.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
When you came back home, and you said, you know, yes, we went there. You and Charlotte did to Oxford. I'm curious, do we see any other signs of Jennifer within Charlotte?
I think so. Not so much of me. Charlotte, you know, is a much better person than I'll ever be, I'll say frankly. In Charlotte, there are touches of my late mother, who was a lawyer for many years here in Canada, and then later a judge. And her kind of focus was advocacy for the rights of women and children. And she was one of these people who very quietly made a huge difference in a lot of people's lives, rather the way that Charlotte tries to do throughout the course of the book. And then more with a focus on the present, my sister, who works in a neonatal intensive care unit in Toronto, and she does a lot of work that's focused on the parents of her little patients and their families. And again, she has that same kind of quiet resourcefulness that I so admire in Charlotte. So there are really more, I would say, Charlotte bears more the signs of the women who've inspired me than you know, any elements of my own character, apart from, you know, the less nice elements, such as you know, being stubborn and being, you know, you know, like myself, I think Charlotte can get very focused on what's in front of her and not be able to see the forest for the proverbial trees. But you know, she was maddening at times. When I was writing the book, I would find her character. And I know people, you know, react and say, is it possible to feel as if the characters are taking over the book? And I have to say, yeah, it surprised me when I first started writing fiction, as opposed to dry, you know, just nonfiction, the history that I you know, was trained to write as an historian. But, you know, the characters do take over after a while, and they will do things that you have no intention of having them do when you set out to write the book. And Charlotte, you know, was difficult to manage at times, and she could be very, you know, at one point, she and Edward are arguing, and he refers to her as Saint Charlotte, that she's holier than thou, and she always has to be so perfect, and it's maddening. And I found it maddening at times, but I didn't feel that I could soften her resolve without compromising her character and the decisions she made. But there are times she and I had quite a few tussles over what was going to happen with her life. And if that doesn't describe what it's like being the author in the author's cave, I'm not sure what else does.
Jennifer, we need to start wrapping things up, but what do you want people to walk away from After the War is Over, having felt or experienced?
Well, I feel what, you know, we have, and I say this in North America, you know, as Canadians and Americans, we have a view of life in the 1920s that it's not an incorrect view, but it's a partial view. The idea of the Jazz Age, the Roaring Twenties, you know, the flappers and all the fun. And that's true for a certain group of people at certain times. But the 1920s were still a pretty tough time for people to live through. more so in Europe than here. But it, you know, it was, it, you know, their unemployment was high in many areas. People had a tough time, you know, making ends meet. But it, and that's just ordinary people, middle class, working class people. So, the, you know, the great Gatsby's of the world had it made. But for regular people, it really were tough through the 20s. And but it's also the case that on top of that is the terrible, terrible trauma of this war, that in Canada in particular, you know, we lost a very significant proportion of our population that would be on par with the losses suffered by, say, France and Great Britain. You know, just it would be something like 68,000 Canadians were killed, which doesn't seem like a lot. But then Canada was a very, very small country at the time. You know, it was, it's the kind of loss you see today. You know, if you walk into, in the neighborhood where I live in Toronto, any church that was built at the time, any school that was standing, any public space has lists, and it's lists of names of the men who were killed. And they're long lists. The church I go to, which was built in 1912, and it was a fairly new parish. This is a, I live in the west end of Toronto. It was a fairly new part of the city, so not really, you know, it not really intensively built up at that point. But something like 60 men died in the parish, and you know, even the parish today, it's a big one. That would be just a huge, huge loss. And I think, well, you know, what of all the people who had to live on after the war, the men who came home and who suffered from what they'd experienced and seen, the men who were wounded, and the bereaved, the millions of people who are bereaved, how, what was like life like for them? And, you know, we're getting to the end of the final few people who can remember that period are passing away. My own grandmother, who was born in 1919, died just before Christmas, and she was 95, and she had quite clear memories of the 1920s, growing up in Scotland and then and coming to Canada. But, you know, she was a very elderly lady, and with those people, those memories, those first-hand memories are lost. And so it's people like myself, the novelists and the historians, who I feel, it, you know, it's... we've been handed a torch, it's up to us. I feel it's almost like a duty to keep the memory of those times and the people who lived through them alive.
You're so earnest. I love that.
Well, you know, it's, I mean, I, there are moments when I was when I write the books and I think, gosh, you know, this can't just be a long summation of society's ills and so on. And so then that's when I think, gosh, I my characters have to have some fun. So, you know, and after the war is over, I send Charlotte and all of her friends to the beach one day, which is a very different experience from going to the beach today. You know, and just, you know, they, people need to have fun. But at the same time, you know, I think it's worth remembering what was lost, and the sacrifices made by people, and, you know, the same sacrifices being made today by military families, you know, in the U.S. and Canada and elsewhere. And it's very easy after the war is over to forget what people have given up. And so my book is just one tiny, tiny piece of the puzzle that's asking people to try and remember.
Jennifer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Rebecca Sherm is the author of Unbecoming, a debut novel of psychological suspense about a daring art heist, a cat-and-mouse waiting game, and a small-town girl's mesmerizing transformation.
Unbecoming is a novel about the making of a femme fatale. It's about her transformation from this little girl who's tragically anxious to please into a very complicated criminal. She and her childhood sweetheart plan a heist with his friends, and they're caught, but she gets away. And I'm not spoiling too much there, because that happens, all of that happens pretty early in the book. And it's also a love story, or really three different love stories, none of them at all straightforward. Love rarely is. So it's a psychological suspense novel and a character study about creating identity and dismantling identity and transformation.
When I first looked at the blurb for it, I thought it should be a black and white Cary Grant movie.
Yes. Well, it's not surprising that you say that, because I was so deeply influenced by watching Alfred Hitchcock's films with Grace Kelly, especially in my youth. And I think watching those films just repeatedly as a child are a big part of how I ended up writing this book.
What's your favorite Hitchcock film?
Rear Window.
Rear Window. Mine is Northwest.
Which I also love. I mean, the thing about Rear Window is that I saw it for the first time when I was probably 10 years old. And a lot of Hitchcock's plots, Dial In for Murder is about insurance fraud and, adultery. And a lot of them are about spies and Nazis. And, when you're a kid, that's very far away. But Rear Window is really just about spying on the neighbors and trying to get the attention of a boy who won't pay attention to you. And I think for a 9 or 10 or 11-year-old girl, the movie actually makes a lot of sense.
So it just dawned on me, you say you're a huge Hitchcock fan. You talk about Grace Kelly. Your protagonist's name is Grace. Is that a coincidence?
No, that's not an accident. When I watched her as a child, I became really obsessed with her. It's unusual for, a girl born in 1985. But I became sort of obsessed with her style of performance, the way that you never forget that Grace Kelly is acting. She's not a very realistic actress. And at the time, I would see her, sort of perform this elegant feminine ideal. And that character was sort of consistent in most of her movies. And I started to believe in it. I started to think like maybe it would be possible to become that woman. And then, of course, once I got older and I became a messy, complicated adult woman and realized how strange it was that I believed that as a girl, that sort of tension about feminine performance and acting and truth in life, it all started to seem like an important psychological knot for me to untangle. And that's why I named her Grace.
Huh, I love that. And so now you are not new to writing, but this is your first published novel.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you kind of got to this point?
Well, you can say that I've always been a writer. I was that kid writing little stories in my room. They're always the same story, always about a magical horse who died. But when I got older, I really tried hard not to be a writer. I was worried that, that I would die of tuberculosis in a garret. So I worked in publishing for a few years after college when I was sort of trying to do something more practical. But I would come home every night and I'd be working on my stories. And over time, that started to feel like my real life, and my work life didn't feel like my real life. And at that point, I knew that it was time for me to take a leap. And I guess I sort of figured, well, I'm broke in New York, and I'm not a writer. I could live anywhere else and be a writer. So then I took the leap, and I came to grad school in Michigan, and that's where I wrote this novel.
Oh, my goodness. And how long did it take you?
About 4 years. It's hard to know what time counts as working on it, because I was writing it for 4 years, but I was thinking about it for probably a year before then. It was sort of cooking.
Isn't that interesting the way it happens? I mean, it really does have to cook.
Yeah, and it takes a long time to hatch a novel, even just to sit down and to have sort of the imaginative confidence to begin. I think it works best for me when I really think about it for a while before I start.
So now, how do you feel to have this hardcover book that you can hold in your hand? I mean, it has a dust jacket and everything that you can take off. You could wear it on your head. You can do whatever you want. I mean, like, what's going through your mind as you think about this?
It's completely surreal. It's hard to believe that any of this is happening to me. When I am looking at the book, I feel like I'm in a dream. It's only when I'm talking to people who've read the book and they're giving me they're telling me about it and we're discussing how they read the ending and we're having these really engaged and sometimes passionate discussions about the book, that's when it feels real and I think, oh my gosh, you really did this. You're really having this conversation about your work with someone else, and that's what feels really great.
Was there any time during the writing process that you just thought, you know what, forget it. It's just, I'm going to go on to something else. This is not going to happen.
No. And I know that that's very common, and I've certainly felt that way about other projects. There were many times when I worried I couldn't do it, when I thought, what if I'm not smart enough to tell the story that I'm trying to tell? And what if I'm not good enough to tell the story that I'm trying to tell? But I always had faith in the story. And so I was always sort of trying to rise to meet it. I knew that if I could hang on, you know, if I could have faith in myself, that eventually I would get there. But it was quite painful at times when you feel, you know, that you're not equal to the story that you're trying to tell. And I think that's something that all writers face. I think that's a common demon.
Oh, absolutely. And now, are you and Grace, BFFs? Do you still kind of mentally hang out together?
No. Oh gosh, I don't think that I would recommend Grace as a good friend to anyone. You should probably lock your doors if you see her coming down the street. And we're not similar at all. And it often when I would have Grace in a situation. I would sort of be asking myself, well, how would you react to the situation? And the way that she reacts is different. We're made up of different stuff. And for me, that is sort of the motivating drive in writing fiction, trying to understand someone completely different from you. And that was really thrilling. It's sometimes very difficult. It's sometimes kind of awful.
And you have an amazing wonderful tour schedule, many events coming up that people can see from your website, Rebecca Sherm, SCHERM.com, including on February 2nd, you're going to be with Paula Hawkins, which
right.
I think is very exciting because her new book, The Girl on the Train, is just, you know, capital T, capital B, the book that everyone is talking about right now.
Yeah, Paula Hawkins and I really like each other's work, and we also have a lot of this. We also share influences, and so I think that'll be a fun conversation.
That is lovely. And what is it that you're hoping that people are going to walk away from Unbecoming having experienced?
Well, you know, Unbecoming is a book that feels, you can read it like a thriller. But it's rewarding. It's much more rewarding if you read it as a character study as well. And if you can make yourself sort of, you know, slow down a little bit, which, you know, I'm one of those readers who takes paragraphs in gulps, so it's hard for me. But Unbecoming is a book that will unsettle you and make you uncomfortable. But I think that you'll be thinking about it for days afterward.
And, you know, there's not one consistent place in Unbecoming. There is more than one setting. You talk about being unsettling. You know, there's a lot of moving around. Did you physically get to take some field trips to some of these places?
I did. I got a grant to research in Paris for 5 days when I was probably in the middle of my process. And I sort of had just enough money to get there and then not enough money to do anything. And that ended up being perfect because, you know, of course, Grace is totally broke and so was I. So for 5 days, I was by myself and I was wandering around Paris. And, you know, we all think of Paris as this grand romantic city, a place that is just lit up with love and excitement. And if you're by yourself without any money, and, you know, you're far away from the people you love, it feels very different. And that romance sort of doubles back and feels a little sad and lonely. And that was really the perfect experience for me to have to try to sort of act out Grace's life, to figure out where she worked and where she lived and what she ate for dinner and retrace her steps. And that was truly an unforgettable experience of inhabiting the character.
And with this book, what do you want people to see about you, Rebecca Sherm, the writer?
Well, I think that what this book expresses about me is that as a writer, I'm someone who wants to look at a really messy psychological knot and tease it apart, thread by thread. That's what motivates me as a writer and what motivates me as a reader. And so if that interests you as a reader, then I think that my work would suit you well.
Are you working on another novel already?
Yes, and I started it pretty closely after I turned in my final edit for Unbecoming. And it sounds very different on the surface. It's about an American family who is moving to a private space station to be guinea pigs.
Oh, my goodness.
Which sounds very different. But, you know, I was thinking about it yesterday and realized how much it has in common. I'm still very interested in the lies that people who are very close to each other or believe they're very close to each other tell each other, and the links that people will go to become who they want it to be. I still have all these same concerns with identity and deception and performance.
I hope you're going to get a grant to go up to a space station.
I don't. All of the research that I have done about going to space makes me absolutely sure that I do not want to do that.
We'll let the imagination take care of that one.
That's right.
Rebecca, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. It's a pleasure to talk with you as well.
If you'd like a copy of Unbecoming, I have one to give to you. Win it by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. While you're doing that, I'd like to thank all my guests tonight. So thank you, Crassi Zirkova, Rebecca Sherm, Jennifer Robson, and Stuart Onan. I loved talking with each of you, and I love all of you who tuned in tonight. Thank you so much. Any ideas for authors to feature on future shows, please do send us an email, find us on Twitter, or find us on Facebook. We always love to hear from our listeners. Until next week, when we come back to you next Monday night, have a fabulous week with fabulous reading. Take care.